You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
You know, every time we start talking about the council, we tell you how it's a bottoms-up organization and that, you know, many things that happen with this council that behind the scenes you have no idea about. That's what this program has done. And interestingly enough today, and I told you earlier in the show, you're going to meet a scientist that's involved in stock assessments and gathering information and hopefully not putting it in the covenant of the Lost Ark and finding it someplace, but where it can be used really, really efficiently to help the fishery. And that being said, is where you come in. So one of the takeaways I hope that you get from today's program, or today this segment, is how can I be of help? And how can I have faith in what's going on? And so that's in some sort of an introduction to our guest. Her name is Cassie Pardee. She is a scientist. With the council, and interestingly enough, started as a contractor and was actually helped into her profession by the council in the first place. So it's like, wow, welcome. Nice to see you. And, you know, we sort of met earlier at one of the fishers' forums. Were you surprised or were you happy to see that there are people outside of the scientific community that really are interested in what you guys do?
Yeah, it was really nice to see lots of people from the community. Mm. That's kind of where my passion is, mm-hmm. is to bring the science to the people. And so I liked seeing that there was a lot of other people interested than just scientists.
You know, it's not easy to become a scientist, you know, and when that happens, it happens after a long effort and I guess a pretty major commitment. What was it that got you interested in it, first of all, in science at all, and specifically the fishery?
Before coming out here and starting my master's degree, I was actually a Peace Corps volunteer, mm-hmm. in the Philippines. And so I worked with the local people in the Philippines to create a marine protected area.
Okay.
And work with their fishermen. So that is what really got me into fishery science and how to protect the fisheries and the fishermen.
Just out of curiosity, because everybody knows, you know, we've seen here in Hawaii forever, made in the Philippines on this and that. My dear friend Andrew Dietrich from Geobunga, they have these river stones, you know, from the Philippines, stuff from the Philippines. Did you get worried, or is there worry down there that they're using up their stuff, that they're just grabbing and shipping out everything they got?
I mean, I lived really out in the rural mm-hmm. areas, so there was no big factories or anything. Mm-hmm. And they were very into conservation and trying to protect what they have left.
That's really cool. Because it's just the native knowledge of, hey, this is it. I mean, you know, if we take all of these things, we're not going to have any left. In other words, self-policing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what my counterpart always talked about was, people have this idea of farms and stuff, and you have to put into the farm to get out of it. And
sure,
so that's what we were talking about in the fishery too. You have to put in to get out of it too.
But what I'm interested in the transition you made from the Peace Corps to a laboratory.
Well, I was looking for grad programs mm-hmm. that focused on fisheries and fishery management. And I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to come out here to Hawaii and work on stock assessments.
That's when we got you, right?
Yeah.
You got your scholarship. You came here and said, originally, where was home? Where did you start?
I grew up in Arizona.
Really?
Yeah.
About as far away from the ocean as you can get.
Yeah.
But what is interesting, and I think maybe I'll tell you this, you don't maybe not know this, and I know a lot of our listeners won't know. You know, we call ourselves a boating state, right? Hawaii, right? There are more boat owners per capita in Arizona than there are in Hawaii.
Oh, wow. That's
it's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, people don't know it. I mean, they think of Arizona as, you know, as deserts. And you guys have a lot of beautiful lakes and all kinds of stuff there.
Yeah, well, I grew up in the desert, but there are lakes.
How long did it take to become to get your master's, to have a PhD?
Oh, I don't have a PhD, just a MS, but it took 2.5 years.
Yeah, just an MS. Like, I don't have one of those. I'm looking for one. But it must be gratifying to see what you've studied to be able to be in practical use. And I'm wondering how technology and some of the other things that you guys use to do these stock assessments, how it makes the job, I don't want to say easier, but more accurate maybe?
So I use a lot of the data from the fishermen, mm-hmm. so the commercial catch data.
Sure.
And it's really improved over time. So in the beginning, we have a 60-year record. And so in the beginning, it was just what fish you caught and how many trips you went. Mm-hmm. And now today, it's what gear you used, how many hours yeah. you were fishing. So it's gotten a lot more intricate so we can have better estimates of what's happening.
What I think Cassie is talking about now, and I'm going to ask her to explain this to everybody, is that you think you're fishing from the minute your boat hits the, you know, off the trailer to the minute you get back. But now we found out that that's not the case. So what you're really talking about, travel to and from, isn't part of the quotient. Why is that?
Well, the travel time, you're not actually fishing. So mm-hmm. we want the amount of time that you're actually taking to fish. So if you're a spear fisherman, it'd be how much time you're actually in the water.
Yeah. So in other words, a spear fishing trip might have started at 4 a.m, right? When you get to go to Zippy's and get your coffee
right.
and get your ice and get your stuff put in the boat and drive the boat, find the spot to throw the anchor in the water, but then you're only in the water for an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we want just that hour mm-hmm. time and not the 5 hours before that too.
What is the end result of the information mostly that you are gathering, these stock assessments? What are they being done for? Are they being done to regulate the fishery? What's the primary reason for these assessments?
Well, hopefully we want to use the assessment to get better knowledge of how many fish are in the ocean
mm-hmm.
so we can set a take limit, an ACL.
You know, and that one of the things that Cassie explained and some others explained at the Fishers Forum, and that's going to come up again in March, is another one. And that is simply that what you're looking for is not to penalize anybody, but to see what the area really can sustain itself. In other words, if you have a certain species, and we can talk about maybe certain species that you're comfortable with, but let's just take a bottom fishing species, like onaga or something. If you keep pulling out onaga and don't count them, pretty soon you can't find them anymore. And so isn't it what you're looking for is the number that we can take and still have it replenish?
Yeah, so we're looking for the maximum amount that we can take that will still replenish itself. So mm-hmm. for future years, you can continue taking it.
It would think, and I've been asked this question, I'm sure it's come up before, that when you're working with the fishermen, that they might want to underreport what they're catching because they're afraid if you knew how much they were really catching, you'd establish a bunch of limits. And I'm wondering if the number just doesn't come from a different way. How do you arrive at the numbers of sustainability?
Well, we're looking at a lot of things, especially for stock assessments. You're kind of taking into account the life history of the fish, so mm-hmm. how often they reproduce, and then the abundance from either surveys or from catch and effort data and from the catch. So we're trying to use mm-hmm. all these different things. And so the more accurate that fishermen can be, the better data that we have.
It used to be, as a commercial fisherman, you were given a catch report booklet. And I hate to tell you, but back in the day when I first had them, they actually had carbon paper in between the pages. It was really antiquated. Now it is so much more user-friendly. Do you think that that's helped? I mean, is the current generation maybe of fishermen a little bit more responsive with regards to understanding the value of these assessments?
I think so, and I think it's a lot easier now. Like you said, now you can just do it online.
Yeah.
I've gone to look at the Fisher data from back to 1948. And before, when they're entering it into the computer, there can be a lot of mistakes.
Like, sure.
And now if you're entering it in yourself, that middleman is taken out.
What I think that is important to explain to people is that the decision-making process, sometimes it's taken out of the hands of the people that really know what's going on. In other words, the village fisherman, or in your case, the scientist has got a real study. And a lot of times the decisions are made by people further up the food chain who really rely on the work that you and others do to provide them the basis for an answer. Do you think, do they pay attention? I mean, are they really looking at this as being valuable data?
Well, I hope so.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of nice to be a scientist and not have to do the management side either,
mm-hmm.
because then it's just the facts and
yeah.
you can just put out your report.
Yeah, you do what you're going to do.
Yeah.
Here's the numbers. Here's but more importantly, maybe you can explain what are some of the contributing reasons why these numbers are more valuable today in the way that they're gathered.
So right now for a lot of the coral reef species, the catch limit is just 75% of what has been caught in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's not really taking into account what we, what the biology is or the abundance. And so if we're using these stock assessments, those ACLs, those catch limits can actually be
annual
higher.
Annual catch limits, folks. You know, I think that, and also, and what I learned at the forum, and anticipate we're going to learn at future forums, is that, you know, there is no blanket a way to determine what fish is available where and when, because it's not anecdotal, is it? That a lot of these people will show you, they don't breed. These fish don't breed in March in our neighborhood. They breed in July. You know, I mean, there are some big differences.
Yeah. And so a lot of the data that is published is either published for Australia or some other place,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't really apply to our fish either. So
yeah.
we need more life history data to get better results.
What makes Hawaii different from some of these other areas? Is it just distance? Because, I mean, when you take, say, reef fish, it's unlikely that reef fish in Hawaii have come from another reef somewhere else, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's distance, and it's also just we're an island. Mm-hmm. So islands have different ecology than land masses like Florida or Australia.
Do people get confused between the different assessments that you do? I mean, when we talk about reef fish here, that's an inshore fish. It's not a pelagic fish. It lives in the reef, and if you take care of it, it keeps reproducing. Is the gathering the information techniques different?
For some reef fish, it is in areas like Guam mm-hmm. and the Marianas. They're really data limited. They don't have as much data. They don't have that great commercial catch data that we mm-hmm. have here in Hawaii. Here in Hawaii, we do have this 60-year data frame that not a lot of people are looking at. And so it's we have a lot more data than those other places. So fish here, it's a little bit easier to do stuff.
You know, I do know that I can remember, and some of our listeners will remember here, that prior to the acknowledge of Ciguatera and other problems, that the reef fish were traded at the auction, and they were traded in the back of every grocery store and everything else. And then people got a little gun-shy, particularly because they didn't want to sell somebody a fish and make them sick and then be responsible for it. Has that impacted the reef fishery with regards to the desirability of species, and maybe some species growing back because people think they got Ciguatera, so let's not eat them?
Maybe. I haven't really looked at too many reef species here in Hawaii mm-hmm. yet. I'm just starting.
Yeah.
But I've been looking at uhu, which was mm-hmm. my master's degree, and Ciguatera hasn't really affected that stock. So
that's pretty interesting, and you may want to explain that. I'm not sure that any of us really know all about Ciguatera. But it's safe to assume that when you take a look at your species, ooh, which we all love, is that we know what they do. They nibble on the reefs all day. So it doesn't look as though the reef is a primary supplier of Ciguatera.
Right. So Ciguatera is kind of built up into the food chain. Mm-hmm. So more fish that eat fish are going to have higher levels of Ciguatera than the fish that kind of eat algae.
Are people surprised at how many different parrotfish there are?
Yeah. Because here in Hawaii, we have 7 different species of mm-hmm. parrotfish. However, in the commercial catch data, it's all just marked as uhu.
As uhu, right. And you know, and I think it's kind of cute because of the fact that you come from Arizona, and you had to probably glom onto all of these names and everything else. It's tougher and tougher for a fisherman. But what is an uhu? I mean, why are these 7 species of uhu, why are they called that? I mean, is it because of what they eat? Is it because of how we eat them?
I'm not sure why they're all called that, but they all look very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's actually kind of difficult to tell them apart. I mean, some uhu are bigger. The bigger species are larger.
Yeah.
But when you're out fishing, they all kind of look the same. So that's probably why they're all lumped together.
You know, I do know that there's a great deal of criticism, and rightfully placed, on people that go diving at night, particularly because the uhu, I guess, at that time is really defenseless. Do they sleep? Do they lie down there and go to sleep? What do they do at night?
Yeah, uhu go to sleep. They go in little pukas in the mm-hmm. corals and just sleep. So really, if you're spearfishing at night, you can kind of pull them out.
It's really not fair.
Yeah. Right?
but yet that's, I know, a big issue. And there are a lot of people that do that. And I also don't know if we know, and maybe the science is starting to lead, about the growth spurts. In other words, when you see a nice big blue uhu, how old is it?
It depends. There's been some research that says they can live up to 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a long time.
But yeah. Some of the younger species only live up to 9 years. Mm-hmm. So there's a big difference between the species.
Can you imagine the challenge it is to be born a little baby uhu and live 9 years?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, their biggest predator, I guess, is us. But who else eats uhu? I mean, I've seen eels bite uhu. I mean, it really just depends. What part of the food chain are they, besides us, are they working with?
I think groupers mm-hmm. and other fish-eating fish will eat uhu. Just everyone
there,
likes
are there
it.
People that can get confused about grouper thinking they're an uhu?
No, they look very different.
Yeah, and I do know that, by the way, here, when she's talking about that, if you take a look at hapupu, the big ones, they could probably eat a lot of uhu.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you know, just out of curiosity, I mean, I know that because we've always loved steamed uhu and done choy sum and Chinese. What's specifically different about the meat of uhu and say, other reef fish with regards to its desirability or its consistency or whatever it is that we love about them?
I'm not so sure, actually. Uhu has that, like, nice... I don't even know.
Yeah, I think I think it's soft, but it's firm, you know? And I think that one of the biggest things about uhu for a lot of people that like reef fish is the bigger ones, you have fewer bones to deal with, and they're a little bit safer to feed children.
Yeah, but I've talked to some fishermen and the commercial guys, and they don't want the biggest ones, mm-hmm. Mainly because they're harder to sell to the hotels and the restaurants. So they're looking for a very specific size that are easier to sell whole.
Right. Yeah. And therein lies the difficulty, because if that's the size you target, what sort of information has science been able to determine about what are the breeding sizes and what maybe what stage of their life should you really think before you take them?
Right. So right now there's a regulation that you can't catch uhu unless they're 12 inches mm-hmm. or bigger.
As a commercial. Right.
Oh, and recreational. Yeah. However, the largest uhu species, the red-lipped parrotfish, mm-hmm. It doesn't even reach sexual maturity until about 14 inches.
Wow.
And so...
So anything you take underneath that, you're penalizing the food chain.
Yeah. But Maui has started to change its regulations. So mm-hmm. now it has two different size regulations for the smaller ones and the bigger ones.
You know, I don't know if it's as simple as that, but it kind of is. And I do know that there are some areas that are remote and some areas that are not. And just as a quick question, a lot of people know that this is a take year in Waikiki. And, you know, it's that whole area. Is there any way that you or that others in stock assessments have looked at that? It seems to me, and we talk about this every year, it comes up all the time on my program and others, that a year is not long enough to let an area rest. Is there anything to say about it? Because, I mean, there used to be uhu all over Waikiki, big ones.
I think there has been some studies that have looked at, like, the off years and the on years and to see how much of a difference it makes.
Mm-hmm.
For the commercial data that I look at, it's not that small of an area because mm-hmm. the commercial zones are a lot bigger. So when I'm looking at it, I can't really see a difference because the blocks are so big. But
okay, now one of the things that I'm interested in, and if you're just joining us, Cassie Pardee is a fishery scientist at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council and currently involved in stock assessments. And that used to be sort of a nasty word, and now it's really not, because they're so much more valuable. And I want to spend a few minutes, if you will, on convincing people that have the opportunity to help on why they should, or if they've never been asked and they want to, how they can. So let's talk about that. I mean, you know, because your work in the field is important on you coming up to me if I've got a bucket of fish and talking story with me about what I'm catching.
Yeah, so one of the biggest unknowns, especially in Hawaii, is the recreational fish and how much recreational fishing is happening. And so if there is a survey or a creel survey where someone comes up to you and asks you, oh, how much have you caught? How long have you gone out? That's really important information, because right now there's just not a lot of detail about how much recreational fishing is happening.
You used a word which I love, and I'm not sure that everybody in Hawaii knows, but you called the creel. And that of course is in a Creole. And back in the days, I guess they were invented by Native American, by Indians, and they made out of wicker. I don't know, maybe made in Europe. But isn't that you would keep it submerged? You'd catch your fish, you put it in the Creole, and you keep it submerged. So what you're talking about is you're just fronting up to somebody at a beach or something, and they've got a cooler or a bucket or a Creole full of fish.
Yeah, and so it's an intercept survey. So someone comes up to you and has like a clipboard and asks you questions about how much you caught, what you caught, and stuff like that.
You know, maybe it's important for us to be told or reminded that we are kind of different from other places, because I think that the amount of take that we have in Hawaii is probably larger than in other areas, because we're so comfortable with eating the fish that if we can go out and find them ourselves, we will.
Yeah, I mean, Hawaii has this big tradition of fishing, and it's built into the culture. But in Hawaii, we don't have any recreational licensing, so we actually don't know how many people are fishing, whereas that's every other state.
You know, that's a point that she makes. And if you weren't with us earlier, Cassie actually comes from Arizona. You know, if you go fishing in Arizona, you have a tag and you have this, and somebody's going to come up to you and say, hey, Cassie, let me see your permits. You have to carry that stuff with you all the time, and it is monitored.
Yeah. So every other state has licensing for recreational fishing, but here in Hawaii we don't. And that's kind of a good thing and a bad thing.
The bad thing is that you're sometimes prevented from really knowing what's going on. The good thing is, I guess, that there are sustenance and indigenous folks here that resent control and restrictions, and it's understandable. But I've found, and I'll see if you think, particularly in the local community, in the Hawaiian community, they're for gathering of information, because they need to know what's fact and what's fiction.
Yeah. So right now, I mean, there's all these different estimates of how much recreational fishing is happening. Some say it's twice as large as the commercial fishing. Some say it's over 10 times bigger than the commercial fishing. And so
that's a big mood swing. I mean,
And so if we can get a better handle on that recreational fishing, we'll be able to better tell how many fish are in the ocean and how much fishing is actually happening.
How does the council, in this case, how do you and others doing stock assessments get the word out that it's time to participate?
I think like radio stations like this and just a lot of community involvement and community outreach, just to tell people, because a lot of people just don't know.
I do know that there are some people that are, you know, like I'm an offshore guy, and if somebody wants to know, where did you catch the mai mai? He said, well, kind of out there, you know, banks or whatever.
Yeah.
What colors? All kind of like green and yellow. Aren't people just as protective on shore as we are offshore as to where I caught it and how many I caught?
Yeah, a lot of people have their specific spots, and they've been going there for a long time, and they don't want other people to know, especially the big commercial guys. They have their secret spots.
When you do that, those assessments, how important is the geographic part of it?
Well, with the commercial data, when you're filling in your commercial reports,
it's by the grid.
So that's all we know is by the grid area, and we're very careful to only, when we're reporting the data, we can only have three, we have to have a minimum of three fishermen per grid area. So we don't want to give away anyone's secret.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that once that gets understood, that you're likely to get a little bit more cooperation. And I'm thinking that sometimes even what they see is valuable. I mean, let's say that somebody, you know, is a guy that's out there catching, say, holy holy or something. And they catch, you know, 20, and that's all they want, but there's a big pile of them there. Sometimes I think they will share that information. You know, I only have three, but there's plenty over there.
Yeah. And, I mean, that is all taken into account into our stock assessments. We are not assuming that when you go out, you catch everything that you see. But it is very helpful when people talk to us and tell us what they've seen and the changes, because we're not out there.
I'm so excited now, and even though I've been a commercial part-time and full-time commercial fisherman in the past, that every now and again I'm proud to see even some of my old pals releasing a fish. I mean, you know, when you do that, I think that if anybody takes away anything from our discussion today, one of those is going to be how long an uhu can live.
Yeah.
And also, what you say in some of them, how long it takes before they are able to breed, or able to give. What keeps you rolling? What's the light at the end of the tunnel with regards to what you're doing and having it work out so there's some harmony in the fishery?
Well, it's kind of like a big puzzle, especially with coral reef fish. There's so many species that are being caught, and it's just interesting to be able to kind of figure out what's happening and just give that information to the managers so they're better informed at the end of the day.
Let me ask you this. I mean, obviously, it's impossible to survey all the species. There's just too many of them. But is it safe to assume that if you're doing, say, a study on uhu, that the same results might apply to veki or to moana or some of the other fish that share the same part of the fishery? One would say, well, if we're sustaining the uhu stock, we're probably sustaining the goldfish stock.
Yeah, probably. A lot of the trends that you see for uhu or for these reef fish are all pretty similar because when the fishermen are going out, they're not just targeting one specific species.
Yeah,
they're
especially if they got a net.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, and I do know that we've had a lot of programs, both with DLNR, DoCare, and with council and others, about the importance of if you are going to use the net, to use it properly. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure as a scientist, it must kill you when you see all of these fish that didn't get eaten, they just hang in the net and die, and they, you know, they just get wasted. Do you see some of that when you're out there on the beaches? See people being a little bit, maybe, if not more responsible from an ethical thing because they're afraid of enforcement?
Well, unfortunately, most of my work is just on the computer.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't get to go out as much as I would like. But I think a lot of people are trying to be more responsible because of DoCare and worrying about.
Well, what about the people that actually ask somebody? I do know that if you're at the other end, like at your computer, all of this information has come to you, and now you have to make some sort of sense out of it. But I think that initial contact with the person walking on the beach up to the fisherman is pretty important.
Yeah, I think that's really important, especially. I mean, I really love it when fishermen will talk to me because it gives me some backstory on the data that I'm getting. So just any sort of story or context to put this data in is really helpful.
I think that there's something at the other end, and that is the satisfaction in somebody who contributes to a survey or an assessment by saying, well, gee, I didn't know what it was going to be used for, but now I'm in agreement. In other words, it's not all about trying to penalize somebody from fishing. It's trying to create ways to show them how they can fish more sensibly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's not about penalizing. It's just about getting the information to know if you can maybe fish more on that stock or fish less so that there'll be more in the next
year. You know, one thing that comes up all the time with regards to, say, bottom fish is that when they reach their quota and it's over, people have that desire, that yen. I'm Ono for this or I want that. And then now they're looking at fish that may be coming from somewhere else. So it is pretty important, isn't it? That maybe it can be told that, all right, there is one species that's doing really well. So why don't you eat them?
Yeah.
Especially if you're a spear fisherman, right? That you can go out and make a selective decision about what to spear.
Yeah, with spear fishing, it's great because especially if you're out there every day and you notice that maybe the veke aren't doing as well and you don't see as many, then maybe you'll shoot an uhu that day or something.
Yeah, so that's a good point. Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's the kind of stuff that keeps you going, right?
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us today. See you at the next Fishers Forum, which
is when?
Thank you. It's in March. Coming
up. It's in March.
Yeah. That's going to do it for this time. If you want to hear something on the show, you know what to do. Drop me a line. The easiest way is still the Mike Buck Show at AOL.com. Thanks to our friends from Life Raft and Marine Safety. And a little bit about that Paddle Smart program. And remember, if you want to know more about what Cassie does or what's going on at the council, go to WPCouncil.org. That's WPCouncil.org. So for everybody at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, thanks for joining us for Go Fish. See you next time.